Casey Foundation.
Good morning and welcome to True Talk. This is your host Samar Jarrah and my co-host Ahmed Bedir. We're going to be talking with a very interesting lady. Her name is Nadia Rubin. She's a political community organizer, political and community organizer, but she is also of Libyan descent. And today we're going to be talking about what happened in Libya. A few weeks ago, we started talking about the Arab Spring or Arab Awakening, and we started with Tunisia and Egypt, and now we're gonna go to Libya. Listen to this song from Libya, and this is WMNF 88.5 FM. And welcome back to True Talk. This is your host, Samar and Ahmed. You always say that, Ahmed. This is Samar and Ahmed.
Do I?
Yeah, I think you say...
Good morning, Samar. Good morning, listeners. We're on True Talk, our weekly global affairs radio show. Samar and I are here in the studio. Samar, you're streaming on Twitter. Mm-hmm. You have dozens of followers watching you right now.
On your average, Twitter account. We have 2,000 people.
I've noticed two things. And not to comment on women's appearances, but since you've been streaming, you've been doing like dressing up more, mm-hmm. and also you've lost a lot of weight.
No, I know you want to say it. I wear more makeup.
Oh, okay. And that's dressing. Yeah. You're wearing makeup.
I lost weight, you know, because of my braces and exercising and
okay.
And now clearing.
And so this is deliberately, you're losing weight on purpose.
Well, it happened because of the braces, but then I seized the opportunity. But I'm trying to dress up a little bit more nicely. But, you know, it's confusing because they said on the Weather Channel, it's going to be in the 80s and I'm cold. It's in the later.
Well, it started out cold and it's going to get warm up. It's going to warm up really fast.
Okay.
But it much, much better than what was happening up north with this polar vortex.
But... Do you know, yesterday we were, or today we're 100 degrees more than them, but they're going to get very warm. But Ahmed, we have to remind our listeners that next week we're going to be fundraising. And I hope that you're going to help out with your fundraising skills. You're always better than me. Although I think the last time I met my goal and even went beyond it. So to our listeners, you don't have to wait till next Friday. You can start. By going to WMNF.org and click on the tip jar or go to the schedule, click on True Talk on Fridays at 10 a.m. and then you can donate. Whatever you donate will not go to Ahmed or myself. It's going to go to WMNF. As I mentioned in the beginning, we're going to be talking about the Libyan revolution and what happened there and still going on. So in order to do that, there is a very interesting documentary, just like we did with the Egyptian Revolution. It does mention lots of things. There will be Arabic language, but it's about chance, and I think you will get the gist of it. So please listen for a few minutes about this Libya awakening. And when we come back, as I mentioned, we have in the studio a WMNF voice that shows up on Thursday and every Thursday, Nadia Ghubain. She's a political and community organizer. Her mom is an American. Her father is Libyan. And she is, of course, going to be talking about what happened and is happening and will happen in Libya. Listen to this fascinating documentary for a few minutes. And I think Ahmed is streaming live on Facebook too.
Across the Arab world, people have been reaching for freedom. But in Libya, the fight goes on. A country and its people demanding the end of a dictatorship. This is the story of Benghazi, the city at the heart of that revolution, and of a man who fought to give its people a voice.
We want our human rights, our basic human rights. We want to be free. Long live Libya. Long live free Libya.
Thursday, February 17th, thousands of Libyans come out onto the streets. Two days earlier, a small peaceful demonstration for human rights had been bloodily suppressed by the Gaddafi regime. Now, crowds several times larger were demanding his downfall. No one knew what to expect or how the security forces would respond. But this was the start of an uprising. By the end of the day, Libya's streets were covered with blood. Gaddafi's security forces opened fire with live ammunition. The city had become a battleground. As some protesters ran for cover, others tried to fight back. But all the guns were on the government side. The injured were taken to the city's main hospital. It was soon overwhelmed with the sheer number of casualties, leaving medical staff stunned by the experience.
We saw things you wouldn't imagine to see in 100 years. It was like a war. Then we started to see people wounded in the limbs, the upper limb, the lower limb. And then we started to see people with massive wounds, big wounds to the chest. To the head, mostly in the first few days, they were to the head. They were fatal deaths.
Within days, over 200 people had been killed and hundreds more wounded. But already the cracks were opening in Gaddafi's regime. His soldiers began to defect rather than continue the slaughter. In a top-floor room of Benghazi's courthouse, Mohammed Nabous was calling on all people to overcome their fear. Mohammed Nabous never dreamt of becoming the voice of a revolution. On February 15th, 2 days before the demonstrations, he was at a party without a care in the world. From a wealthy background, his interests were always in running the family business. But the uprising changed everything.
We are peaceful people. They are killing unarmed civilians. Help us by supporting us. Put pressure on Gaddafi. Tell Gaddafi to leave. Ask him to stop killing us.
But on the streets, most fought with whatever they could find. Rocks, knives, petrol bombs, and a mere handful of guns. Gaddafi's forces prowled the streets, shooting at anyone they could find. Eventually, the sheer number of protesters forced the army back into the regime's hated Katiba compound. For years, this stronghold at the heart of the city has been a symbol of the regime's unchallenged power. Now people had to overcome their fear to breach its walls. The cost was high. As the stronghold crumbled, the people's strength grew. Within a week of the first demonstrations, eastern Libya was in the hands of the people. The people had found a voice.
Mais o chuva já zara.
Everyone wanted to express themselves in any way they could. This newfound freedom inspired Mohammed Mabous.
And welcome back to True Talk. The just this audio that you were listening to, talking in Arabic, is Mohammed Nabous. And Mohammed, we had him on True Talk. As soon as this thing started to happen in Libya, I was on Skype live, and it says Samar Jarrah, USA. So Ahmed, it was like late at night, and comes this person and starts typing into my account, "Are you a journalist?" I said, "Yeah, I have a radio show." He says, "Okay, my name is Mohammed Nabous. I am from Libya. It's what I'm doing is very dangerous. I'm trying to find people to get our voices. Can you do something?" I said, "Yeah, I can have you on the radio show." So we had him on the radio show via Skype. It was a very terrible connection, but we were able to talk. I had him, then 2 weeks later I had him, and then his voice was gone because he was assassinated. And then his wife came on his Skype account and mentioned exactly what happened, and I played it here, and I think people were very, very, very affected, because WMNF and True Talk is bringing these voices live from Libya. And this is why we are very happy that we have in the studio Nadia Rabin. As I mentioned, she lives here in Tampa, and Nadia is a political and community organizer. But Ahmed, I think, Ahmed, if maybe we need to refresh the memory of our listeners, that something happened that triggered all this about 8 years ago.
Yeah, in 2000, at the end of 2010, actually, into 2011, it started with Tunisia, when the young man who was a street merchant,
Bouazizi,
put himself on fire, basically burned himself alive in protest of the injustice and the oppression that they were facing, that triggered mass protests in Tunisia and eventually to the overthrow of the dictator. And that started a domino effect. It went later to Egypt on January 25th, then it spread to Libya, and it spread to Syria and Yemen.
Bahrain.
And even Bahrain. And most of the places, or all the places, the revolutions have, they started out as uprisings. They called them the Arab Spring. People were demanding democracy. There was a lot of hope around that time. I was so inspired, I actually went back to Egypt. We talked about that last week, to participate in it, because I'm originally from there. I'm an American citizen, but born in Egypt. And it also spread to Libya. Now, in most of those places, it failed or it's not successful. In some places, it was the revolutions were I guess, countered or, you know, eliminated, what's called counter-revolution. In some places, it became a civil war. In some places, it became like Yemen, where, you know, there's a coalition and the war still happening there. The only really success story so far is Tunisia. Now, Libya is a special case because the United States intervened in there militarily with NATO, and they overthrew Gaddafi. But then after that, in the aftermath, a lot of bad things have happened, and now there's still some instability. There was, at a time, some parallel governments. Or two parallel governments.
Several.
And they still don't have necessarily a peace. So we're joined here by, and I'll put her on my camera because I'm streaming live. We have Nadia Rabin. Is that my saying it right?
That's right.
Welcome to True Talk.
Thank you for having me.
You are a Libyan American.
Yes,
were
I am.
Were you born in the U.S.? Or
yes, Libya? I was born in the U.S. I traveled to Libya from a young age, from the time of elementary school. We would go at least every summer, every other summer. And I lived there.
So you were going there
from
during
a young age.
The...
From a young age I went there, and then I lived there.
But were you going there when there was an embargo?
Yes, I went when there was
remind people.
Right.
Before the revolution, or the uprising happened in Libya for
there
a long
sanctions.
Time. There were sanctions against Libya.
Right.
they were so, you know, the sanctions were so severe, you didn't even have flights out of Libya.
No.
And it was, you know, I think, did it start under Reagan or under Bush?
It was, I believe it started in the late 80s.
The late 80s.
Yes.
So how were people traveling in and out?
So at that time, they would have to go through either to Tunisia or through Egypt. So you have to travel by car.
Okay.
Or actually, you could take a flight from, you know, Tripoli or wherever to a border town or somewhere nearby, then take a car to the next country over. And then, you know, this caused a lot of hardships on Libyans. Things were very hard to access at that time, in the late 80s and into the 90s. I mean, even simple things we take for granted, you know, that are imported, because almost all, I think, a large percentage of Libya's products are imported from other countries. So imagine if you have to get, you know, shampoo and clothing, and there's a trade embargo. And it caused, you know, everything to be very expensive as well.
And how did people get by?
They get by like every, you know, citizens of a dictatorship, you know. People come together and they help each other out. Libyans, it's very interesting that this happens, because I don't know, but many people don't know this, but Libya is actually one of the richest countries if you're talking about wealth in oil. I mean, at the time of the revolution, there was, I think, oh, I don't want to give a number and be wrong, but there millions of barrels of oil were being pumped every day. We had several American oil companies, Mobil, Exxon, Italian oil companies as well. But this isn't never reflected in... the wealth was not distributed. It was only for Gaddafi and his children, and that was about it.
So how were they pumping oil, and ExxonMobil was operating during the embargo and during sanctions?
Not during sanctions, I'm sorry. When the sanctions were lifted, I got ahead of myself a little bit. The sanctions were lifted, it was at the early late 90s, I was probably about, or maybe the year 2000, somewhere in there.
Yeah, I remember that there was a time that, I think under the Bush administration,
yes,
they announced that,
yes,
Gaddafi was turning over a new leaf. He was,
right,
giving up his weapons of mass destruction.
Right.
I don't know if he ever had any. And that he was, and this was after the Saddam,
right,
after the fall of Iraq and the invasion. Some people said, you know, he saw what happened in Iraq and didn't want that to happen in Libya. And he started returning, you know, into the, I guess, the international community. So you're saying that's when the American companies, oil,
yes,
companies were going in.
Yes.
Now, one question before we get to the Arab Spring part. Did you think that sanctions were justified in Libya? Because that's a question now that people have, for example, like when it comes to Iran or Venezuela or some of these countries that are led, you know, not necessarily that Iran is led by a dictator the way that Saddam is, but you support like sanctions, or how did the Libyan people feel about the sanctions that were really hurting?
It's only,
the
it doesn't hurt the government. It doesn't hurt. It only hurts the people.
Mm.
They're the only people that are affected, and they were, you know, not getting paid, you know, a fair wage, and the inflation increased as the sanctions went on. It's not fair. Like in Venezuela, look what we have there. You know, people can't afford to eat. And so Libyans, you know, if we want to go back in history, Libyans lived for years under oppression. We went from Italian rule to a monarchy for several years. And this is when Gaddafi came in 1969 with his military coup at the age of 27 years old.
And he stayed there for how long?
42 years.
My God.
Yeah. So when the Arab Spring happened, did you support the uprisings that were happening there?
So we were watching very closely what was happening in Tunisia and Egypt, and you know, something you can only feel in the air. Everyone felt so happy. You see what I'm saying? Because we felt hope for the longest, mm-hmm, time. I mean, look at Zayn and Mubarak. They've been around there forever. So we were thinking, you know, maybe this is it. This is our chance.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew very few people who were against, you know, any, who were for Gaddafi, who liked him, unless they were benefiting from him, as happens in every dictatorship. At the time, it was February 15, 2011, there were protesters who had, he was a lawyer. I don't know if a lot of people don't know this, but I want to say 96, there were 1,200 political prisoners killed in one day.
A massacre
in Abu Salim prison in Tripoli. Mm-hmm. 1,200 prisoners. The prisoners had come out to protest the lack of basic rights in prison, a lack of hygiene items and food and basic treatment. They came out to protest. Of course, you know, some they try to, you know, appease them. And their solution was to just, let's murder them all. And that's what happened. 1,200 prisoners in one day.
That was in 96.
So their lawyer, the families of the deceased, got a lawyer. His name is Fethi Terbil. He went to the steps of the courthouse in Benghazi, and he protested. It was a little mini protest all on himself.
When did he do this?
February 15, 2011.
After the Arab Spring.
I mean, he was their lawyer, and it was I believe it was the anniversary of near the time that the massacre had occurred.
Okay.
So this is what happened, and pretty soon it was, you know, two people, then 10 people. They had a small little nice little protest going on. Of course, you know, I think they went and they came again the next day, and then the next day the numbers got larger and larger and larger. And this is when, on the 17th of February, I think it was one of the largest numbers recorded, and Gaddafi forces came out and actually shot at the protesters and killed them. They didn't shoot at them with, you know, BB guns. They shot at them with anti-aircraft missiles.
They were heavy
artillery. They didn't use tear gas. Yeah, okay. They didn't use tear gas.
So this would have been like, I guess, Mubarak stepped down on the 12th of February, 2011. So about a week later,
right?
The security forces in Libya started killing the protesters in Benghazi.
In Benghazi.
There are two main cities, not capitals, but two big cities on the coast of Libya. One is Tripoli, the other one is Benghazi,
and
right?
Tripoli, Libya has the longest coastline, I think, believe, in all of North Africa, if not the world. One of the longest coastlines.
So then what happened after they killed the protesters on the 15th?
While I was in Libya at that time, the news networks, of course, inside the country, completely shut down. If you turn the television on, unless you had satellite TV, it was, of course, like summer show. There was people like Mohamed Nabous who would come out. But these were small messages, and people were using Twitter and Facebook. They had shut down internet, of course. Mobile phone usage was minimal at times. I believe it was the morning of February 20th where on one of the major news stations, Jazeera or Arabiya, they were showing, they had actually taken the people who had protested and collected their dead bodies on the streets and burned them in the street.
Wow.
Okay, wow.
So let's just remind our listeners, it's True Talk on WMNF 88.5 FM, and Ahmed and I are talking to Nadia, who is an American of Libyan descent, and we are talking about the Libyan revolution. Before we continue that, I was looking now, Ahmed, at the BBC line on Libya, and what people don't understand sometimes is that it's a very, very old country with a very old history that let me just read a little bit so people can get perspective. 7th century BC, the Phoenicians settled in Tripolita in western Libya, and which was inhabited by the Berbers, who are the original people,
the indigenous people of North Africa.
Exactly. And then 6th century BC, Carthage conquers Tripoli. 4th century, the Greeks colonize it. 74th century, the Romans conquer Libya. AD 643, the Arabs under Amr bin al-As conquer Libya and spread Islam. 16th century, Libya becomes part of the Ottoman Empire. Italians arrive on the 1911 and remain there. And they assassinate Omar al-Mukhtar, who organized the early Libyan organizer of civil disobedience and revolutionary.
He's a Libyan hero.
And a Libyan hero. So Libya.
Safe to say, by February 2011, we were sick of being colonized.
I think, yeah. So I mean, Libya had an extensive history of being occupied.
Right.
So you also consider Gaddafi as a form of occupier, or at least, I mean, he was the first.
He was an oppressor.
Oppressor.
You see what I'm saying? We have many. My father was a dissident. He came in to the U.S. in the late 70s. Gaddafi had, you know, start wars with, you know, Sudan or with Uganda.
Yeah.
And he sends, you know, takes teenagers from high school and, you know, takes them on a bus and says, okay, you're going to war today.
He was very strange.
Yes, he was very odd.
Wrote this, the Green Book.
The Green Book, yes.
Like, I mean, I was living in Cairo when these things were happening, and he was assassinating dissidents in Cairo.
Yes.
He would send hit squads.
Yes. He has assassinated dissidents here in the United States as well. We have a number of large community, mostly in the D.C. area, of Libyans who came in during that time. They left the Gaddafi regime. Some of them worked for the government. But it's safe to say that we're sick of the oppression, sick of being told what to say. You can't speak against the government in any form. You can't be a journalist. No way. You can't.
It was an extreme case, I would say.
Even
Libya,
the television.
If we compare it with the rest of the Arab regimes. However, we thought
he would knock the houses over of anyone who spoke out against him.
Yeah, he was a brutal dictator.
Right.
No doubt about that. However, this revolution or uprising or awakening didn't go as planned by the people. I remember when I was talking to Mohammed Nabous, and I would say, what do you want me to call for? I mean, tell me, what do the Libyan people want? Do they want any foreign intervention? And he says, over our dead bodies. And later on, some people who claim their love and relation with Mohammed Nabous would say, no. He later changed when the regime became very brutal. Mohammed Nabous wanted foreign intervention. So really, I want to hear from you as a Libyan who is in the studio. Did the Libyans want NATO to come and bomb them and help them?
As someone who was living in Libya during 2011, during the civil war, people say, you know, look at the mess that we did, the United States and NATO and France caused in Libya. We know we shouldn't interfere. At the time when I was there, there were people being shot at on the street. They were being killed for protesting. They were being killed for, having a cell phone and posting on Twitter or to Facebook. My father was one of those people. He was arrested in the summer of 2011 because he had a keychain with the independent flag of Libya, which is no longer the plain green flag. I'll get into that later. But as far as foreign intervention, I believe that's the only way. If you remember, in March of 2011, there was a long convoy traveling to Benghazi. It's 13 kilometers long. This man had a 13-kilometer long convoy traveling towards Benghazi. He was going to obliterate the entire city. There was no way he was going to allow anyone to live. He was going to destroy anything and everyone in that town because it was the root of the uprising.
So people felt that if foreign troops come, it will help them save their lives and maybe really help reform or bring...
At that time, there were no seen foreign troops on the ground. They were mostly in the air, and they would bomb weapon depots and things like that. I'm sure they were giving some support in some areas. I don't have a lot of details on that.
Okay.
Though.
So the way that Gaddafi was captured and killed was a little bit controversial. And I actually, Ahmed, I do have a very, very short clip on Hillary Clinton.
So, that is the land of unconfirmed.
Yes, we came. We saw, he died.
Did it have anything to do with your visit?
No, I'm sure it did.
Very interesting.
What did she say?
Let me.
Let's repeat
let
that
me,
again. This is Hillary
she's famous
Clinton.
She's famous for this now.
For this line?
Yes.
Yeah, listen.
So, I mean, that is the land of...
Okay, let me just explain. This is CBS... very, very short clip in a longer interview, and the lady, the journalist, is asking Hillary Clinton. Hillary is extremely in a festive mood, as you can see. So let me play.
So, I mean, that is the land of unconfirmed.
Yes, we came, We saw, he died.
Did it have anything to do with your visit?
No, I'm sure it did.
Did you hear that?
Yes, I did. I mean, I just wanted to make sure that our listeners heard it sometimes. But I was surprised by your comment, Nadia, saying that foreign intervention is the only way.
In the beginning, we didn't want foreign intervention because we didn't want what's going on now.
Right.
But at the time, when you have a 13-kilometer-long convoy traveling, you know, filled with artillery and weapons traveling towards a city, I mean, he wasn't planning on, you know, leaving any stone unturned. I don't believe that anyone would have survived.
But did you trust the intentions of NATO and the West as far as... Because there are reports that right before NATO decided to strike at Gaddafi, that South Africa was on the verge of negotiating some sort of political solution, and the U.S. went and NATO went through with the bombings anyway. I mean, looking in hindsight, do you still think that foreign intervention was the right thing? Or
in hindsight. You know, hindsight is always 20/20.
Yeah.
In hindsight, we probably would have had the same result we have now.
Mm. I mean,
whether or not NATO would have been involved. Some people, they wish that we have Libyans in Libya who wish that the revolution never happened. You know, things could have just stayed fine the way they are. At least they were.
This is all over the Arab world,
yes.
especially in Egypt.
This is something that the Arab dictators wanted and their, I guess, supporters around the world wanted. That's the message they wanted to send with these counter-revolutions, whether it was
a
civil
us.
War, is that, you know, if you rise up, you're going to regret it. And they basically made the people regret. So even in Egypt, where there was a revolution, the situation got so bad there that lack of security, they sabotaged everything to make sure that it fails, that people just said, hey, we don't want any revolution.
Well, this is Saif al-Islam, Gaddafi's son, who was destined to take over his father's place when his father, you know, inevitably died or, you know, before the revolution. He came on February the 20th and basically threatened the entire country, telling us, this is not Egypt. And he did his finger just like this. I pointed at the screen and said, this is not Egypt. This is not Tunisia. You know, you don't know what you're doing. Everything's going to be expensive. You're not going to be able to afford to eat. You know, you're living in utopia and heaven right now. What are you complaining about? He gave Libyan citizens, he offered like each family like equivalent of, I don't know, maybe $500 or so. Basically, this was your hush money. Mm. So $500, you know, to not protest.
Eventually, they were able, with the support of NATO, with the airstrikes, the rebels were able to overthrow Gaddafi.
Right.
But then there was all these factions.
Right.
You know, they weren't unified.
Who was Haftar? This man who all of a sudden
came afterwards.
Yeah, right? But he all of a sudden like leaves Virginia, because you mentioned that there are a lot of Libyan expats.
Right.
What was special about him that he became the voice of Libya, the new Libya after NATO and after Gaddafi?
Haftar was in Gaddafi's army. He was, he's a dissident because he actually tried to form a coup inside, while he was, I believe it was when Libya's at war with Sudan. And so,
Or Chad.
I'm sorry. Thank you. Not Sudan. Chad. So when they were at war with Chad, what happened is, he formed a coup with a number of, people inside the army. Gaddafi found out about it and, squashed it. And a number of those people came to America and as prisoners of war.
Sorry, our listeners, I was trying to get some video set up here, but this is True Talk on WMNF 88.5 FM. We're going to be fundraising next Friday. So if you are enjoying the conversation with Nadia and Ahmed and myself talking about personal witness account of things that you may be hearing about in the news, but Nadia was in Libya when all this was happening. So please go to the tip tip jar and go to WMNF and donate as much and as little as you can to True Talk. We're going to be raising funds next Friday at 10 a.m., but you don't have to wait. You can do it now. And Nadia, we were talking about Haftar, and I'm getting a lot of messages, by the way. Maybe, Ahmed, you can read them from your account on Facebook.
I don't see them for some reason.
Yeah, maybe because it's your own account. So a lot of people are sending questions, and they, I think some of them is, okay, what do we do now? Or at least maybe our listeners need to know what's like the situation now, like one,
situation,
two, three,
four. The situation now is, you know, it's, we have long history of turmoil and war, and here we are again, 8 years on. Unfortunately, we have two governments essentially going on right now. We, in the West, we have a UN-appointed president by the name of Sarraj. He was appointed by the UN after some talks that happened in Algeria, mm-hmm. and he is the internationally recognized president right now, or leader. In the East, Khalifa Haftar has said, no, sorry, that's not how this is going to happen, and he has essentially formed a counter-revolution, saying that there are pockets of the...
old regime?
He's essentially what's happened in Libya right now is we have people calling for basic democracy, mm-hmm. you know, as are in many parts of the world, and people who are fed up are saying no, let's just bring Haftar in, he's going to be our savior, and this is actually an essentially military rule. What's happened in Egypt? Sisi and Haftar are good friends.
Yeah. So now into all this mess,
right,
came ISIS.
This is what I was going to talk about next.
Okay.
Is there ISIS?
So there is lawlessness, let's say, in the country.
Basically, militias are running the country.
Okay.
You know, the internationally recognized leader, Sarraj, his hand or his, you know, his control does not extend much outside of Tripoli, of the west, western part of the country. It doesn't extend to the east. And Libyans are very divided right now.
Let me maybe, if you can tell us a little bit about the geography, because Libya is vast.
It's a very large country.
Like, how about the south? Were they part of what was happening during the Gaddafi regime? And were they part of this revolution? Or they are more like tribes that drove from one area to the other?
Unfortunately, what's happened in the south of Libya is during most of the history of Libya, and especially during Gaddafi's regime, the south has been forgotten. Many of them are...
Are they what they are called?
Tawarek. So they are mixed. So Tawarek are actually part of the Berber tribes as well, mm-hmm. and Tebu, which is also another tribe. Some of them are of African descent, mm-hmm. or you know, mixed with, you know, Chad or Sudan. But they are still Libyan citizens, and unfortunately, they have been mostly forgotten and marginalized.
So where do they stand from all this that's going on? I mean, are they part of what is going on, or?
I believe they're part of it, but it's happened even inside the city. It's not even before it was, you know, the west, east of this part, the west. No, even inside the different areas, people are split. Right. And what Haftar has done, he's essentially used ISIS, similar to the way Donald Trump has used xenophobic rhetoric, saying that, you know, the immigrants are coming and they're going to take over your country. He's used the card of
ISIS. Like,
right.
Everybody waves the card
right.
of
the
ISIS.
Extremists are coming. You know, are there pockets of ISIS inside Libya? No doubt. Is it
everywhere?
Is it everywhere?
Dangerous?
Exactly. And is it danger?
Didn't they kill a number of Egyptian workers?
Right, Coptic
by the
Christians
beach,
at the beach.
Christians. I mean, they do exist.
But who,
there.
Who introduced, or it seems like to me, with, and this is the same thing that happened in Syria, once the rebels or the people that are seeking revolution start getting a foothold and moving the country forward, comes in the terrorists.
Right.
And it seems like there are foreign countries or, you know,
no doubt.
External part groups that are introducing and bringing these terrorists or
weapons,
allowing
right.
them to grow
right.
in those countries, so those dictators can say it's either us a dictatorship or ISIS. And I think, you know, Assisi uses that example. Bashar al-Assad uses it. And one of the reasons, you know, the revolution failed in Syria is because of these external, you know, violent groups.
Well, there's
that were
no doubt there's. Well, we have also foreign countries
that are intervening. So, for example, one of the things I want to ask you about the role of the Gulf countries, like the UAE,
right?
You know, and Saudi Arabia. It seems like they seem to be the ones that are heavily funding groups, or like Haftar and other militias against what was seen as a legitimate government.
Right.
Is that true?
Yes.
Why do you think that that's the case? Why are these Gulf countries are far away funding these militant groups and military operations?
Well, you're the foreign policy expert. Why don't you tell us, Ahmed?
Okay, well, you're the guest today.
Well, I'd like to hear your take on it.
Oh, my God. Oh, okay. Let me just remind our listeners, this is Through Talk on WMNF 88.5 FM, because somebody told me we have to do this all the time, Ahmed, every 7 to 10 minutes.
That's right.
Has
it been that long?
For us, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, my take is that these groups don't want democracy in those regions, that they want to make sure that they fail, because democracy is contagious if it's successful.
Of course, everybody
in Egypt,
is
if it's successful in Libya, then eventually, you know, those monarchs will have to give up their seats.
Which brings me to a very important question. Of course, Libya has tremendous oil.
Right.
And I'm looking at the map. They seem like the oil is more to the right. And there
like
is some
east or west,
east of
mostly
the map.
Mostly the eastern part of the country.
Yeah, and there is some in Tripoli. There are few lines or oil fields that go to the bottom where the...
In the south.
Yes, in the south. I keep misusing my...
Geography.
No, because I'm looking
the
at the map.
The bottom and the
so,
top
no,
and
I'm
the
at
right
the
and the left.
Okay. But you get it. It's right, west and east. So anyways, where is the oil? Like in all this mess... of Haftar, Saraj, all these groups, and Daesh, oil is flowing, or it's not?
It's not as it could, which is the issue. And you have the militias, you know, once they get upset, if they're not getting what they want, they'll come and they'll shut down, you know.
So they can do it.
Right, to shut down the oil field, so... You know.
But does Libya have a lot of reserves?
Yes, we have. There are a lot of reserves, and the problem is they're mostly in the east. So there have people who've called on, you know what, if the east wants Haftar, let them have Haftar.
But why is that a problem?
Because
you have one whole country, but the resources what
are
Libya,
all on the eastern are on the eastern
so they're
side.
All fighting over
and
the
that's
eastern
where
side.
Right, it makes sense.
You're right, but it seems like the western side where Tripoli is like more developed. That's where the capital
is. Yes, because Gaddafi, he only focused on Tripoli during his time.
And ignored Benghazi.
Or Benghazi in the south.
You know, when we talk about Benghazi now, it just reminds me, of course, also our listeners, we heard a lot about Benghazi during the Obama administration,
right.
What happened there. What happened in Benghazi with the attack there on the consulate?
You know, the way it was portrayed in the media at the time... I mean,
Benghazi attack, September 2012.
That's right. The consul at the time, he was well-loved. I remember he'd come to Tripoli. There's a famous place in Tripoli, it's Mizran Street, where people go to get like fresh croissants, and they get like these like frappes, and it's a very like a home, you know what I mean, like a corner shop, but it's well-known. It's, you know, tens of years old. So he was pictured, you know, there. Eating there several times. He was invited into people's homes. This guy was well loved.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Spoke
they liked him.
Arabic. And
yes, he spoke Arabic.
Even his mom.
He appreciated the culture.
Yes.
Yeah, his mom said, please don't politicize my son's death. He loved the Arab world. He loved the culture.
But why did they go after? What happened there? Because at the beginning, it was like, this was in reaction to this
the cartoons.
The Muhammad cartoon.
Right.
But what was the whole thing behind the Benghazi attack? I mean, from the Libyan people's perspective.
I don't believe that, you know, Libyans wouldn't go after the... You see what I'm saying? Would, like, purposely go after the...
Because the Libyan people liked him.
Right. He was loved.
Right. So
and
who...
I believe this demonstration was used.
Okay. So you... I mean, I think what you're trying to say is that some groups...
Right.
took advantage of the time of the demonstration.
There were skirmishes that happened outside the embassy.
Right.
And
right.
ran into...
And then they took advantage of that chaos or to attack.
Right.
But what was their motivation? Just to create...
To create chaos, as they always do. At that time, there were extremist groups.
I think I'm reading here again, Ansar al-Sharia, they were...
So Ansar al-Sharia, and they're the ones that took credit for it. I mean, these groups, they just, called
themselves
whatever.
But at the time, the media had portrayed it as like they're parading with the ambassador's body in the streets, which didn't happen. He had died of smoke inhalation.
Yeah,
and they were taken to the hospital. But they always like to portray,
us as crazy.
Right, as crazy or, criminal or...
And people buy into it.
Yes,
so people. Like the people were upset, the Libyans.
Yes.
Because they were trying to save him and they did the mouth-to-mouth recitation.
Libyans, as many Arab countries, they love foreigners. And they there were even Hispanic people. I remember in Tripoli, I've met people from Uruguay, and I had met people from Brazil. And these people are welcomed, and they love the ambassador. No one likes to be betrayed like you're some sort of like bloodthirsty, criminals.
Mm-hmm. And that's how they were portrayed.
He was our hope. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. If the American embassy is gone, it closes. Well, then, that's the beginning of the end.
Well, maybe that's what some people wanted.
Of course it is.
To create a division between the U.S. so the U.S. doesn't stand with the, democracy there, the progress. Because I think at the time during the Obama administration, they were kind of, tactfully supporting. They weren't putting all their support behind these new governments, but they wanted to see some progress happen. And maybe somebody wanted to undermine
it. Sabotage.
And during 2012 was... great time. I believe, look at Egypt as well. Things, Gaddafi died and...
People were hopeful.
People were hopeful. And things were peaceful for a long time. And this is... there was no government. We basically had, essentially an anarchy, but it wasn't evident. If it was safe.
But didn't they have elections?
They did have elections.
In 2012 or when?
In 2013.
Okay. And which government came on top?
Which
party came on top? That won the elections.
Oh, this is if you. Depending, there was an interim government.
Yeah, but initially, I think there was a kind of a consensus around one government.
Right.
And then, Haftar showed up.
No, and then in the east, there was another government formed, saying, "Do you see what I'm saying?" That many of those people who were appointed to the government were dissidents and lived in America. A lot of the time, or in Europe, and people were not fans of that. You're not true Libyans. You haven't lived here, right?
You fled. You didn't suffer. Now you want to take over.
And now you want to take over.
Ahmed, let's move forward because what happened to the Gaddafi's sons? You mentioned Saif al-Islam.
Right.
Is he on trial or is he being rehabilitated to come back and rule Libya? Because these people find
that even an option.
Yeah, because she mentioned maybe people are saying.
So his son was arrested and he was being kept by a militia group in the mountain area of Zintan for a number of years until I think about 18 months ago they said he'd been released.
So
they just released him into the
lie.
He could. There's nothing that prevents him from running. There's supposed to be presidential elections coming up soon.
Because like you said, some people are regretting revolution.
And I have no doubt that people...
We should have accepted the sons and the heirs.
Right, because at the time, it was just at the cusp of... Libya was actually starting to improve in 2011.
That's why they carried out the chaos.
Yes.
Interesting. So he can come back and become the president?
There's nothing that prevents him.
Will Haftar allow it, or now we're going to have another band of group going supporting Saif al-Islam against Haftar and against Sarraj? Anything is possible.
Anything is possible.
Gosh, this is a very interesting conversation. We couldn't take phone calls, but I know that we got so many comments on Facebook. I can't read them, although I'm wearing glasses. It's so far away, Ahmed. But we got lots of questions. Obviously, people in America and elsewhere, Libyans, Nadia, are sending messages and questions. I can see them. I was able to read two of them.
Are sending
But who's...
I think I heard your feedback there. Can I just make an announcement?
Very quickly, we have less than a minute to go.
A week from tomorrow, Saturday, February 9th, the local Muslim community is holding a candidate forum. You know, in the city of Tampa, there's an election, so the candidate forum is going to be a week from tomorrow, Saturday, February 9th, at the Islamic Society of Tampa Bay area, starting 1 o'clock. You can go to tampaforum.org, tampaforum.org, to RSVP, and it's going to be a free lunch, Middle Eastern lunch.
Oh, wow.
Really nice. The mayoral candidates have confirmed, city council candidates, open to the public. Everyone is welcome. Please join us at the mosque on February 9th.
Reminding our listeners that we will be fundraising next Friday at 10 a.m. You don't have to wait till then. You can go to WMNF.org, click on the tip jar, click on True Talk, and give us as much money as you can so we can have voices like Nadia and Ahmed and myself remain on the air. This is WMNF 88.5 FM. NPR News is next.